This week, we unveil our 100 notable books of the year, and we will also talk about this year's top 10 books.
What he does in this book reminds you of why his earlier book was so influential.
It's a beautiful book of reportage and advocacy.
You know, I call it a novel, but it's really very, very autobiographical to the point where it's caused problems with his family.
There's just a lot to take pleasure in this book, and I think it is a great imaginative journey.
Julie Bosman will be here with Notes from the Field, and Greg Coles will have bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Joining us now is Sarah Smith, the children's book editor of The Book Review. Hi, Sarah.
Hello, Pamela.
So let's talk about notable children's books of 2013, which the two of us picked together.
That's right. There are 25 of these books, and it was really kind of a struggle in the end to pare it down to this number, though 25 is still quite a few. But when you get down to it, it's not that many of each category.
Many, right, because we have to divide it between young adult, middle grade, and picture books.
That's right. And particularly, I would say, with the picture books, it's almost, you know, it's very difficult because there are so many wonderful books every year.
And I think one of the things that's interesting about this year on the young adult list is that two writers had two winners each.
Rainbow Rowell has two books on the list, Eleanor and Park and Fangirl. Eleanor and Park is her first young adult novel. She had written one book for grown-ups before. And it really took the world by storm. This is a great love story about misfits in a suburban town and their great relationship and how it sort of changes their family lives too in interesting ways.
Our reviewer, John Green, I think, made that book in many ways in saying that it reminded him not just what it's like to be young and in love with a girl, but also what it's like to be young and in love with a book.
That was just great. And of course, John Green himself helped to kind of redefine the YA industry with his book, The Fault in Our Stars. So he knew what he was talking about, and I think a lot of people listened. Her second book, Fangirl, is a very charming, very different story about a girl in her first year at college who is sort of struggling to find her way there and is writing fan fiction online when she's not doing classwork and also develops a romance despite herself while there.
And our other winner with two books on the list is Jean Luen Yang.
So Jean Luen Yang had won the Prince Award for a graphic novel called
American-Born Chinese.
American-Born Chinese, that's right. And so he has these two companion novels that are really intriguing. He took a very challenging subject, the Chinese Boxer Rebellion, and turned it into companion novels that take as their protagonists characters with very different perspectives. So one is a Christian girl who imagines herself as a warrior saint, and the other is a Chinese village boy who's on the opposite side of this conflict. And they're amazing books, the visually extraordinary, and also managed to tell a very complicated story in a nuanced way.
One of the things that strikes me about the young adult notables this year is that more so than other years, I think the books are really crossover. They have a crossover appeal with adults. I mean, sometimes we'll have books on the list that seem very purely YA, paranormal, or romance, but the books here, a lot of them, I think, found a real audience with adults as well. There was Rose Under Fire, which is a companion novel to last year's Codename Verity, a story of a friendship between two girls in World War II that was a huge hit with adults as well.
That's right. I think that's interesting, and I wonder if it shows in some way the move away from the dystopian fantasy novels that were so popular a couple of years ago. They're still very much there. They're on the list. The Fifth Wave and The Rhythmatist both have fantasy elements, but I think that we see more of the contemporary or real-world books here.
Yeah.
And maybe that appeals to grown-ups more.
It's still genre, but it's different strains of genre than we've seen in the past. I mean, I think we're definitely, as you said, moving away from paranormal. But Brendan Sanderson writes this high fantasy / science fiction, and he, of course, is well-known to adult readers from his having picked up the Wheel of Time series. And then with The Fifth Wave, it's kind of post-apocalyptic / aliens. And in our pages, we had Justin Cronin, who has written this kind of genre for adults, review it very favorably.
No, it's a great list. And I think that you can see that adults who were hungry for more of their favorite writers would turn to it, even if it was, even if the books were geared ostensibly towards adolescents.
Let's just switch quickly and talk about some of your favorite picture books of the year.
I would say Mr. Waffles is a book by David Wiesner that is really extraordinary and did not win a Times Best Illustrated Award, but very well could have, I think. In this book, a house cat discovers a little colony of space aliens under a radiator in a suburban house. It's really a very strange and wonderful book with incredibly clear pictures. And I think that children will love it as they try to figure out what's actually going on without words, which is a fun challenge for readers of any age.
I mean, Wiesner, who's won 3 Caldecotts, is, I think, just brilliant at that kind of open-ended story. He did The Great Book Tuesday, in which suddenly these frogs start to fly, and there's never any explanation. You know, he's a little bit like Chris Van Allsburg in that way, in that he really kind of opens things up for readers to take their own journeys and create their own visions.
Right. You sense there's a mystery in the world that humans may not even be aware of because it's under the radiator or someplace that they're not looking. And there's a depth to the pictures which gives them real a real feeling of mystery and magic.
And I think another one of your favorites did win Best Illustrated, speaking of journeys, was the debut.
That's right. Erin Becker's also wordless book, Journey, about a girl who draws a doorway on her bedroom wall and enters this magical world in which she can fly and chases a bird and eventually finds a friend who then comes back with her to her own world. Becker's drawings are incredibly detailed. In the real world, the little girl lives in a brownstone in some place like New York. Architecturally, the pictures are incredibly accurate, and there's so much to see everywhere you look, including scenes underneath the house of what's going on below the sidewalks. And there's just a lot to take pleasure in this book, and I think it is a great imaginative journey.
It's a bit the premise like Harold and the Purple Crayon.
It has very much the same idea as Harold and the Purple Crayon, and the idea of drawing drawing an entrance to an imaginary world is definitely not unique, but the look of the book is totally different. The idea of the book really as a journey is a much more fully realized one.
What were some other of your favorite picture books this year?
Well, some books are notable more for their content in words than they are really for their drawings. And The Boy Who Loved Math, which is about the mathematician Paul Erdős, is a marvelous book with, I should say, lovely pictures. But the story of Erdős's life, if that's how you pronounce his name,
Erdős, yes.
Erdős, is very interesting for older children to read. Anything that draws children into math and into the quirky personalities of mathematicians is marvelous. And this book did that really well.
This is a book that Nate Silver reviewed for us together with a really also a lovely picture book, not on this list, but about Albert Einstein on a beam of light. And he just said, you know, this is just a book for young nerds. But it's also, I'd like to say, a book for children who maybe are a little bit unconventional in terms of their approach to academics, because Paul Erdős, of course, had a hard time in school. And I think that it's really comforting for children, especially perhaps boys, who don't like to sit still in classrooms, to read about other ways in which genius and inspiration can occur.
And that's true of Einstein, too, who I think didn't speak for a long time.
Yes.
So, you know, these unconventional children often turn out wonderfully, and reading books about them, as you say, can be great for the kids and also for their parents. It's nice to remember that not everybody has to be well-rounded all the time. Another book that's a real standout is Africa is My Home by Monica Edinger. And this is about a West African girl who was taken captive from her home and was on board the Amistad as a slave when older slaves took over the ship. And she eventually made it back home to West Africa, but only after a very long and legal battle to return. And she spent some time in New England where she was educated. She returned to Africa ultimately as a teacher there. I think what's interesting about this is that Edinger used non-fictional material, including news clippings and other sources like that, in the text. But the narrative voice is of the girl. So, of course, that's fictionalized. And it's very accessible. I think kids will love to read this book in this first-person voice. And the illustrations by Robert Bird are just extraordinary. And my favorites were actually of her sleeping in bed, dreaming of her African home, but under colonial quilts. So it's really a lovely, lovely book with a lot of layers to it, fictional, non-fictional, and visual.
Now, Sarah, we, of course, picked these books together because I was the children's book editor for the first half of the year until you so brilliantly took over. But let's each take a moment to talk about maybe one other book on here that's a real favorite. I'll go quickly first, and then let's hear your pick. Mine would be The Cats of Tanglewood Forest by Charles DeLint, illustrated by Charles Vess. It's just, this is a gorgeous middle grade novel that feels like one of those books that's been around forever and is handed down. And one of the things I love about it, it's a magical story about a girl in a forest and cats and, you know, mysterious characters. One of the things that I think made it very special is the design of the book. You pick up the book and immediately it feels different. The paper is, the book is a little bit heavy in a really wonderful way. It feels like an object of art, and the illustrations are full color, many, many full color illustrations on the page, even though it is a novel, and it just feels like a magical gift of a book. All right, your turn.
One book on this list that's a very small book is a picture book by Sylvie Neiman called Something Big. Now, this is illustrated by Ingrid Gordman and published by Enchanted Lion, a small New York-based publisher. And this book really grabbed me. It's very unconventional, and part of what's unconventional about it is the way that it looks. The drawings are all on white, sort of creamy white backgrounds, and they're done very sketchily, almost messily, but still attractively, with colors like Loden green and persimmon red. And it tells a very simple story of a child's day. And of course, for most children, there is a lot of drama in every day. And I liked the fact that this writer, Neiman, focused just on that. There's not a lot of action, but there is a major transformation. And it's a lovely, quiet book that says something, I think, very deep about the qualities of a day and what a day can contain.
Well, let's end on that. That was lovely. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you. That was fun.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital by Mark Leibovich. That's This Town by Mark Leibovich, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. This is a big week for Norman Rockwell, right? We just had the auction and some bit of controversy.
It is. There was a huge auction for three of his best-known paintings this week, which fetched a great deal of money. But earlier this week, there was a controversy over his biography, a new biography of Norman Rockwell by Deborah Solomon, who is a freelancer for the New York Times and a former columnist. And she's also written biographies of artists, including Jackson Pollock. And last month, Farrar, Straus & Giroux published a new biography that Solomon wrote of Norman Rockwell. And some members of his family are very upset about this book.
One of the interesting things was that the book came out, and the controversy didn't sort of bubble up for a few weeks. What was the delay?
Well, the book came out in early November, and we're just hearing from the family now. They haven't said anything until this point, until this week, when they said that they have been getting increasingly furious over the reviews that the book has been receiving, which have generally been positive, and also some things that Deborah Solomon has been saying in interviews to promote the book.
All right, so let's not keep our listeners in the dark any longer. What is the big controversy?
So the question that the family has is, why does Deborah Solomon write in this book that Norman Rockwell may have been gay? She also writes, and this is the accusation that infuriates them even more, that he may have had pedophilic impulses. Now, these are two very surprising things to the family. They say that there has never been any suggestion that Norman Rockwell was gay. He was married three times. They said that he, in interviews with me, they said...
Isn't that enough? Aren't those enough marriages to prove the point?
Yes. They said that he was a straight man. He was always flirting with women. He actually had affairs during his first marriage, which he wrote about extensively in his autobiography. And they're very upset at the suggestion. They're even more upset at the suggestion that he may have had pedophilic impulses. And Solomon writes in her book that, in analyzing a couple of Rockwell's paintings, writes that we are made to wonder whether Rockwell's complicated interest in the depiction of pre-adolescent boys was shadowed by pedophilic impulses. She also adds that there is no evidence that he acted on his impulses or behaved in a way that was inappropriate for its time. So if you take those two statements together, you see that the way that she writes it, she says, we have to wonder if he has these impulses. And then she segues right into a sentence saying that there's no evidence that he acted on his impulses. So those impulses sort of became fact right there. And this is not based on anything other than her read of his artwork and one anecdote in the book where she writes about how Rockwell had gone to the home of one of his young male models, a younger boy, and asked for the boy's pants from the family. Now, Rockwell told the parents, I want to make sure I get the color right, because he painted from photographs, and they handed over the pants, and that was it. And Solomon read a lot of meaning into that anecdote.
Why did she think he was gay?
She wrote that throughout his life, he demonstrated an intense need for emotional and physical closeness with men, and that marrying so frequently may have been a strategy for controlling his desires for other men. She also described a camping trip in Canada that Rockwell took with his male assistant, and the men swam together and played cards. And Rockwell wrote in his diaries later that his assistant looked most fetching in his long flannels. Now, that's a little flimsy. I think most people would agree. She doesn't have any secret diaries or journals or any interviews with real people who said that they believed that he was gay. So I think one thing that the family says is that she's taking her analysis of his art a little bit too far.
I do like that quote, most fetching in his flannels. Thanks,
indeed.
Julie.
Thanks so much.
A quick rundown of the 10 best books of 2013. On the fiction list, we have Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, The Flamethrowers by Rachel Kushner, The Goldfinch by Donna Tartt, Life After Life by Kate Atkinson, and 10th of December, Short Stories by George Saunders. For nonfiction, After the Music Stopped The Financial Crisis, The Response, and The Work Ahead by Alan Blinder. Days of Fire, Bush and Cheney in the White House by Peter Baker. 5 Days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital by Sherry Fink. The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914 by Christopher Clark. And Wave by Sonali Dharaniyagala. Here joining us now are two editors at the Book Review, Elida Becker and Barry Guin. We're going to talk a little bit about the process of picking these notable books, the 100 notable books, and then choosing the 10 best and perhaps a couple of our favorites. So, Elida, talk to us a little bit about about the difficulty of narrowing it down.
It's excruciating. And I think that if people knew how many wonderful books there are that never make the cut, they would be just as sad as I am about it. You know, in order to pick 100, you have to eliminate lots of books that really deserve special attention. For example, Jane Gardam's Last Friends, it's the final volume in her trilogy, and she's got lots and lots of fans, and it's just, you know, a perfect present for people, I think, if they've read the first two books. And there are other books that are, you know, weren't deemed quite so successful, but that are also a lot of fun and very interesting. For example, Ronald Frame's Havisham, which is about the life of Miss Havisham before she became Dickens's famous character.
Right. These are our near misses.
The near misses, yeah. And on the nonfiction side, Robert McFarlane's The Old Ways, which is a wonderful book about walking and traveling and all the things that enter your mind as you're doing these things. What I urge people to do is go back to past issues of the Book Review and see what those notable books are underneath the bestseller lists. And you might find some more that you would like to buy.
Was there any book on the top 10 lists that particularly struck you this year?
Well, the Atkinson is terrific. And she's such a fine writer and so hard to pin down because everything she does is her quirky and her own take. And this is, she has a lot of fans because of her mystery novels, but this is a standalone one that's very smart, very complicated.
And fun.
And fun, yes.
Right. A rarity, fine and fun. Barry, on the nonfiction side.
Let me begin by talking about one of the notable books that didn't make our 10 best books of the year. And the book that I'm recommending this year is one that more or less fell through the cracks, and it's Kenneth Pollack's Unthinkable, concerned with the question of whether we should bomb Iran or not. And I think there are two reasons it fell through the cracks. And the first is that it had the misfortune to be published just when the Syrian episode was making the headlines.
This is a book that came out in September.
It was when Syria became the focus of our attention. And so Iran dropped out of sight ever so briefly, because now, of course, it's back and it's on the front pages. But if Pollack's book had come out either before or after Syria, I think it would have gotten more attention. And then the second reason is that I think he has a reputation as being a hawk, because he wrote a very influential book preceding the Iraq War called The Threatening Storm, in which he came out in favor of invading and taking down Saddam Hussein. One of the interesting things about this book is that he has a dovish rather than a hawkish position. If we're faced with the choice of bombing or containing Iran, he comes out in favor of containment. And what he does in this book reminds you of why his earlier book was so influential. He's not tendentious. He doesn't have an agenda. He looks at all the facts and presents a very comprehensive and sweeping argument that's convincing, because you're just persuaded that he's considered every side of the question.
Let's talk about on the 10 best books list. We have among them The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914 by Christopher Clark. And this was one of many, many books about World War I that came out this year, even before 2014. Was it difficult to pick from among the many great books.
This was a real horse race. The other two possibilities, the other two candidates, are Max Hastings' Catastrophe 1914 and Margaret Macmillan, The War That Ended Peace. And both of these writers are just at the top of their game. Hastings is, if not our foremost military historian, one of the two or three best military historians now writing. And Margaret Macmillan has written several prestigious and really great histories. Probably she's best known for her book on the Versailles Treaty, Paris 1919, which I really think is a classic of modern history. And so you had these two, and then, of course, The Sleepwalkers, How Europe Went to War in 1914, Christopher Clarke. It was like trying to decide who's the best quarterback, Peyton Manning or Tom Brady. I mean, you know, you can just have the argument endlessly, and it would be very hard to pick one of the three. But for some very small and nuanced reasons, I think the Clarke won that particular horse
and that
race.
Wasn't even counting the Joe Sacco visual representation, The Great War, which is reviewed in this issue as well. Well, that gives you, I think, a sense. There is always with these lists a lot of complaining about what doesn't get on the list, but you can probably tell there's a lot of agonizing that goes on our end as well. Barry, Elida, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Joining us now, Greg Coles and Parle Sagal, two editors at The Book Review, familiar to many listeners, to talk again a little bit more about the notables and the 10 best. Greg, earlier, Elida lamented some of the books that did not make it to the notables. What did you have some other books that...
I did. You know, the notable books, it's an interesting exercise every year. I saw once a quote from a Harvard admissions officer saying, we get so many good applications that our entering freshman class, we could have picked an entirely different freshman entering class, and they would have been just as worthy. And it's the same a little bit about notable books. We love so many books every year that to narrow it down to just 100, or in fiction, just 50 books out
right.
of all the ones that we've reviewed, inevitably you end up leaving some out who that really could have equally belonged on the list. For me, I would have loved to see Carl Knausgaard's book, My Struggle. It's the second book of a continuing series. He's Norwegian. These books are translated from the Norwegian. And there's something very Proustian about the whole project where he's just, I call it a novel, but it's really very, very autobiographical to the point where it's caused problems with his family. It is just looking at his life and, I mean, kind of his obsessive thoughts about sex and death and family.
Breakfast cereal.
smoking.
It's a lot of food.
Yeah. they are kind of wonderful books as an insight into somebody's mind. And they've gotten good attention out there in the world. And so I think, you know, they don't need that extra push from us on the notable. But certainly they could have ended up there. You know, book two in that series could have ended up there. And I would have been very happy
and
to see gonna it
And there are going to be
there.
How many more volumes?
I think
like
it's
three
a
more?
Seven volume.
Okay.
For
it's,
as
it's
long
six
as
or
he
seven.
Lives.
Well, I think it's projected to be six or seven. And certainly in Norway, some of the further ones have already come out. But yeah.
Okay.
It's,
so next year, Carl.
Exactly. I also would have liked to see the novel Mary Coyne by Marissa Silver on the list. Just a wonderful novel, kind of imagining the life of the migrant mother from Dorothea Lange's famous migrant mother photo. Another novel by Tom Drury called Pacific, which kind of followed up on the characters from one of his earlier novels. And it mixes a little bit of magic, or you're not sure, magic and mythology with just a very kind of straightforward realism. Just a fun book that I also would have liked to see on the list. So, again, there's, you know, a number of books that didn't make the list that were also, in my mind, notable.
Greg gets to publicly air his complaints now. it sounds like a big number, 100 notable books. But again, as Greg said, when you divide it into 50 fiction and 50 nonfiction, and you look at all of the great work out there in fiction, poetry, novels in translation, debuts, short stories, it really is a tough call. Mm-hmm. Parle. Tell us about your personal favorites on this year's notables or best books of the year.
There's so many things, so many books, that, again, like Greg, that I loved. But I also really loved, like, and I think all the books that I really responded to had two things in common. And these are two sort of trends, I think, that are happening in the list. And I started thinking about, are these ways that people are writing now? One thing on the list, there's so many, especially in the nonfiction notable lists, there's so many books about feminists or proto-feminists or going back into history and sort of finding out how this one woman negotiated her life in ways that we could now maybe call feminist even if she didn't identify as such. There's Jung Chang's amazing biography of the Empress Su Shi, who started life as a concubine and then became this. I mean, she literally ruled behind a screen with her little infant in front of it, but she was a huge reformist.
It's like the Wizard of Oz.
And Jung Chang, of course, wrote that amazing
Wild Swans.
Yeah. Gosh, now about 20 years ago or even longer, about her grandmother and her mother and herself.
So she's so attentive to how these things have changed. Another one is, there's a beautiful biography of Margaret Fuller on the list. There is the Jill Lepore biography of Jane Franklin, and even Carla Kaplan's Miss Anne in Harlem, which is a really sort of gloriously complicated book about some very complicated white women who made a place for themselves in the Harlem Renaissance, whether anybody wanted them there or not.
Right.
So these are books that I loved. I also noticed this year that, and I mean, maybe this is something that people have always done, but maybe they're doing it especially beautifully this year, people using their personal relationships or something that's happened to them as an ingress into a larger look at an institution. I'm thinking of The Cancer Chronicles by George Johnson. His wife got cancer, and he started, you know, he's a science writer. He used to work at the Times. He started looking at, what is cancer? How are we understanding cancer now? How are we treating it? What have we been told about cancer? And how much of this bears out? So the parts that I loved, being an incredibly like slothful and unhealthy person, were the parts that were just sort of like, well, how much of those little lifestyle things actually have any scientific basis? That's one book. Another book is To the End of June by Chris Beam, who is an adoptive parent and grew up with a very sort of complicated home life. And she looks at the foster care system, especially in New York. So these sorts of stories I found very, very sort of incredible, using your story and then sort of juxtaposing it with an institutional analysis.
None of those books made it to the top 10, which is also, again, an incredibly tough decision process. What among the top 10 were your particular favorites, Parle?
I proselytize for Wave. I absolutely think
you and I both.
Actually, all three of us.
I said
to Parle, what do you think about Wave as a top 10? Weeks ago, I said that.
We were all on the same page. It is a bullet of a book. I put it up with like C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed. I don't think I've read anything that sort of describes how grief puts you on your own planet. And I was watching an interview with her the other day. Oh, so to give a little bit of context, so the book is by Sonali Dharan-Yangala, who is a British economist, and she was on a holiday in Sri Lanka with her parents, her two young sons, and her husband. And the day after Christmas, 2004, her family was caught up in the tsunami. The author didn't even have time to warn her parents, but she, her husband, and two children ran into a van. The van was knocked over. The water carried them up, and she was the only one who survived. She held on to a branch. So she started writing to try to figure out what happened to her in the water. How did she survive? And as you're reading this book, it becomes so clear that this wasn't meant, like, she didn't mean for anybody to read this. It is so personal. It is so relentless. It is so fiercely furious. I don't think I've ever read anything like it.
It's so hard to find anything to add on to that. I think
I proselytized for Wave.
You know, we were all blown away by that book. Any others on the list particularly want to talk about?
I also really loved, I guess I'm in a very grim frame of mind, I loved 5 Days at Memorial. Another book about water as monster, almost. It's a book about New Orleans.
A natural disaster.
A natural disaster. And it's by the journalist Sherry Fink. And she covers what happened to a hospital, Memorial Hospital, that decided to stay open during Hurricane Katrina, how they struggled to treat the critically ill patients that were kept there. But the reason I love this book is that it's actually like 5 books in one. It starts with the sort of creating the atmosphere, the moments, the days before the storm when the doctors and nurses decided to stay in the hospital, bringing their pets, bringing anybody they could sort of shelter there. It becomes a sort of true crime story as we realize that because of the desperation, because there's no electricity, they're struggling to sort of keep these patients alive. Some doctors and nurses made the agonizing decision to euthanize critically ill patients. It becomes a courtroom drama, and then it becomes a sort of broader look at the ethics involved, at how easily we all break down during disasters. How are we preparing ourselves for these sort of inevitabilities? It's incredibly well done, and the language is just staccato, perfect, and it's a beautiful book of reportage and advocacy.
I would advocate on the fiction side of things for a book that on the surface seems a little bit lighter than either of those, but underneath is actually also quite dark, and that's the George Saunders story collection, 10th of December. It's a book that
you reviewed
all,
for us.
All the way back in January, Joel Lovell on the cover of the New York Times Magazine said, this is the best book you'll read all year, and here it is. Mm-hmm. It's one of our 10 best, one of our 5 best in fiction, and it's true. I did review it in February for the book review. It's a book that I just loved. Saunders has had a career going back a couple decades now where this is his 4th story collection. He has kind of established himself. He writes these very manic, kind of comically surreal and science fiction tinged stories. His earlier collections, there were talking candy bar wrappers and kind of ads that would light up on the sidewalk under your feet, more of like a Gary Steingart, like very broad-based, futuristic humor. And he steps back a little bit from that in this book, and it's probably the most realist book of short stories that he's written so far. There's still absolutely the absurdist, deadpan, you know, kind of flat-out demented gloss. You know, he's a real satirist of American culture. But he also writes with this very deep empathy for his characters, and especially for the underclass. And there's a lot of class issues. It's something in common with a number of books on the list.
And on the notables as well.
Yeah,
I think the economy really made itself felt.
It shades a lot of the kind of significant books that are being written right now. Rachel Kushner's The Flamethrowers also has a lot of class issues. There's a lot. It goes back to the 1970s, kind of the New York underground and Italian radical politics in the 1970s, and especially she's kind of making fun of the Italian elites and looking at inequality in that culture at that time.
All right. Well, a bit of grim content, even if the overall subject is celebratory. Parle, thanks so much. Thanks,
Thank
Greg.
You.
Thanks, Pamela.
We're back with Greg Coles to talk about bestseller news. Greg, not much new on the list this week?
No, well, this is the sales period that included Thanksgiving, and so not a lot of people were in the stores until Black Friday, obviously. And there's just 2 new books on the list in all. They're both on the fiction side of things. There's nothing new at all on nonfiction this week, either in hardcover or on the combined list. So
that is unusual.
Yeah, just nothing new going on in nonfiction. On the fiction side, the only 2 new books, one is at number 10. It's by Adriana Trigiani. It's called The Supreme Macaroni Company, and it concludes her Valentine trilogy about an Italian immigrant and Greenwich Village and an Italian-American shoe designer named Valentine, hence the Valentine trilogy. The only other new title this week is at number 1. It's by James Patterson. By James Patterson alone, not writing with a co-writer, which generally means it's one of his Alex Cross books. He reserves those for himself these days. And the book is called Cross My Heart. It's actually his second Alex Cross book to debut at number 1 this year. I went back. I looked. 28 books so far have made their debut at number 1 on the hardcover fiction list this year. So it's more common than you might think.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.